Welcome, everyone, to this episode of our U.S. Payments Forum podcast. Our topic today is preparing for the rise of quantum computing, opportunities and threats to your business. The content is a result of a joint effort by members of our Payments Fraud Working Committee. My name is Joe Linson, Business Development Director at PQ Shield, and I'm delighted to guide you through the conversation together with my co-host, Roberto.
Hello, I'm Roberto Cardenas from Global Payments, Director of Enterprise Compliance. And yes, I am very excited to be participating in this discussion on quantum computing. What's fascinating is worldwide, an estimated 2.5 billion are spent by governments, venture capitalists, and enterprises annually in the global race to develop the first stable and commercially available quantum computer. I'm curious to learn what the big promise is and why it is such a big deal.
Let's jump right in. Our first guest in this episode is Emil Hansen, CTO of Cryptomatic. Emil, why don't you say a few words about yourself and why the topic of quantum computing is near and dear to your heart?
Sure, I'd love to. And first of all, thanks for having me here. I'm honored to be a guest on this podcast concerning such an exciting and important topic. So now, as you already said, I'm CTO at Cryptomatic, and so I run the R&D division in Denmark based in Aarhus and UK based in London. I've been CTO at Cryptomatic since 2019, where I've focused on improving our development pipeline and increased collaboration between R&D and the product team. Prior to my role at Cryptomatic, I've worked in various companies as a senior developer for cloud infrastructure and services that all had very ambitious goals for their level of quality or security as well. Quantum computing represents a paradigm shift that I expect will have an impact as significant as Turing's bomb machine that helped crack the Enigma codes during World War II. There are extraordinary benefits to these new technology, but also well-known threats to existing asymmetric crypto systems that really call for action now. So organizations that have not already started planning for transitioning to post-quantum cryptography, they risk lagging behind. For a company like Cryptomatic, this is really good news because we have both expertise and products that can help.
Great. Thanks, Emil, for that introduction. And I wanted to raise the first topic here. So we'll look at what is quantum computing and how does it differ from traditional computing to lay the foundation for the further discussion. And I guess if you've not been living under a rock for the past several years, then certainly you've come across the term of quantum computing more than once. And to start peeling the layers of the onion and eventually get closer to understanding both the opportunities and the threats, let's kick off the conversation with our first question. And it's already a loaded one. What is quantum computing and why should you care about it now?
Yeah, good question indeed. And maybe a good place to start is to define what we're all talking about. So quantum computing refers to a particular paradigm for making mathematical computations by taking advantage of certain physical properties in particles. It used to be a theoretical model, but recent breakthroughs have really pushed the boundaries of what can be done in practice. So companies like IBM and Google have been working on or have working quantum computers today, although their computational capacity is still very limited. The big deal, though, with quantum computing is that it's a fundamentally different computing paradigm compared to the classical computers that we're all familiar with in our watches, mobile phones, laptops, and so on. So a classical computer is at its very core a, you know, supercharged abacus that can do number manipulations at incredible speeds. When we started building computers, they were huge and slow. And as we all know, the industry has optimized the size and speed of these machines over the years. It really took off when the transistor was invented and refined. A quantum computer, on the other hand, is a completely different device. Where a traditional computer would have to do exhaustive search in an unordered data set to find a particular element, which could take weeks if we have a trillion records, a quantum computer would find the element in a second. But what's important to realize is that this doesn't mean that a quantum computer is necessarily superior to classical computers in every way. It'll not be the case that everyone is going to need one, and they certainly are not intended to replace everyday computers. But understanding the types of problems that quantum computers can solve quickly will be very valuable once the technology is mature. As the now famous Dr. Sohini Ghose described in her 2018 TED Talk, a quantum computer is not just a more powerful version of our current computers. Just like a light bulb is not a more powerful candle. You cannot build a light bulb by building better candles. A light bulb is essentially a different technology based on a deeper technological understanding. And similarly, a quantum computer is a new kind of device based on the science of quantum physics. Now, whereas classical computers operate on binary representations of data, quantum computers operate differently by working on so-called qubits that are not just binary, but they represent a superposition of 0 and 1, a so-called quantum state that allows the system to evaluate an entire parameter space simultaneously. Depending on the problem the quantum computer is solving, this can lead to exponential speedups compared to classical computers. And everyone wants exponential speedups. The industry has similar expectations for life sciences, where simulation of molecular structures is crucial for enabling breakthroughs in research areas such as drug discovery, material science, and biological processes. Machine learning may also see advantages for classification and clustering algorithms, as well as path optimizations for logistical problems in the transport industry. And last but not least, aerospace and defense are looking for quantum optimizations for logistical and resource allocation problems too. Also, using quantum entanglement in photonics, we can ensure that no adversaries can eavesdrop on networks without being detected and use those properties for quantum key distribution. So really, the entire quantum field stretches across many different academic and technological disciplines. And it makes a lot of sense that we see so many resources invested in research and development in quantum.
It is great to hear that all this money being spent is first and foremost aimed towards positive business outcomes and solving some of the world's biggest problems. Imagine what this computer power can do for topics like cancer research, understanding the climate, or optimizing transportation.
Indeed. It does sound like quantum computers have a really great and, you know, positive potential to have a huge impact on all those challenges. And Emil, it's interesting you bring up the term qubit, which sounds like a quite a fancy term. Maybe you could break that down for our listeners and explain what this actually means and how we measure the computational power of today's binary computer system versus the actual power of a quantum computer.
Yeah, sure. Let me try. And I hope I'll not be offending too many physicists when I do. I'll not dare claim that I understand quantum physics quite to the level that all these experts do, but let me have a go. So qubits are the elementary units of information in a quantum system. And as we all know, classical bits can have a binary state represented as zeros and ones in the mathematical sense, and as DC voltage levels in a physical system, for example, in a transistor. So bits can change state between zero and one by changing the voltage and thereby emulating discrete operations in the system. But qubits, on the other hand, are fundamentally different in that they represent a superposition of zero and one. So quantum states can be implemented in many different systems like electrons, photons, or nanocrystals, what they also call quantum dots, where the physical properties like spin, charge, or polarization are used to represent the basis in a two-dimensional space. So in this way, you can say a single qubit represents not just zero and one, but a range of possibilities in between. And until you measure the qubit, then it becomes either one or the other. So for that reason, qubits are sensitive towards noise in the environment. And in practical applications, you should typically introduce additional qubits and error correction algorithms. Quantum entanglement is probably one of the most intriguing features of a quantum system that distinguishes it from a classical computing system. And as it turns out, qubits can be entangled with one another so that whenever you change one qubit, for example, by measurement, you will instantaneously affect the other one, even if they are separated in space. So the fact that qubits can operate on superpositions of information is basically what gives us those massive speedups on unstructured search algorithms in quantum computers. In classical computing, the current most efficient factoring algorithm can factor the public key of a 2048-bit RSA key in 2 to the power of 117 operations, which translates into ridiculously long time. I mean, the sun is likely to have burned out before we are done with the current hardware. But with quantum computers, however, it'll likely be much faster. There's a lot of debate on how fast it'll actually get, but expect it to be feasible in hours or days at most. It does, though, require thousands of logical qubits, so qubits with error correction before that'll happen.
Thanks, Emil, and that's a great segue into our second topic, where we want to look at the threats that quantum computing will bring along to existing systems. So, Emil, listening to what you just outlined, it does not sound good for system security at all. So, does this mean all our encryption is out the window and broken? Or maybe you could elaborate on that a little bit as well.
Yeah, sure. Well, luckily, not all of it will be, but asymmetric signatures as we know them will. So encryption and message authentication, that's really pillars of any system where data privacy and integrity is important. So this basically means that any modern information system and their security here hinges on public key cryptography. So with public key cryptography, we take advantage of hard mathematical problems, the so-called trapdoor functions, meaning they are easy to compute, but hard to reverse without having the private key. And for RSA, for example, we rely on the fact that we have no efficient classical algorithm for factoring large integers. And likewise, for ECC, where the problem is the elective curve logarithmic function. With quantum computers having enough qubits, however, Shor's algorithm gives us ways of solving the trapdoor functions for both RSA and ECC. And similarly, Grover's algorithm on quantum computers gives us ways of calculating collisions in one-way functions like traditional Sha-hash functions with quadratic speedups compared to classical computers.
This is absolutely fascinating. It is basically a whole new paradigm which is being used to solve mathematical problems.
Absolutely, yeah, Roberto, I agree. And I guess, Emil, whenever we speak about applied cryptography in large distributed systems, such as the financial system, we automatically also need to speak about cryptographic keys and how their lifecycle is managed, how we generate, store, access, update, and protect those cryptographic keys. And so the term post-quantum cryptography, or PQC for short, hints at the fact that there might be some changes and updates needed to prepare our organizations and all the digital business processes for the future of quantum computers being available. How would you describe and propose to address these issues to get towards a post-quantum safe algorithms?
Post-quantum cryptography. So as we discussed at the beginning of the session, any significant information system is likely to use cryptography to some degree. And sometimes you're protecting data that you know is valuable here and now. For example, transactional data that you need to keep confidential between two parties in the system. You might also be signing data to keep record of, say, a contract or software such that other entities can verify that it is authentic. And at other times, you may not even know exactly what data is flowing through your system, but you want to keep the data private by design, and therefore you employ storage and network encryption, just in case it was sensitive, for example, in your browser. So with all that cryptography in your system, you basically added several dimensions of configuration data that you need to have well-established governance procedures for. So just like you want to be able to demonstrate that software version you have in production, which endpoints are active, what their APIs look like, and so forth, you also want to be able to document which keys are used and active in the system at any given time. So it follows that you need procedures for updating those keys as well, so that you know what to do in case of a compromise or when the parameters for those keys need to change. And if you've been good at designing the security of your system, you would have assessed what your assets are and determined what you need to do to protect them. And concerns such as performance and longevity of those assets help determine what cryptographic parameters that you need. And sometimes you may need to take certain compromises if your cryptographic capabilities are limited by the platform. So, for example, for a long time, many systems all worked mostly on RSA of 1024 bits, simply because it took too long to generate longer keys, and maybe the interacting systems didn't even support ECC yet. NIST, they've been recommending 2048-bit RSA keys since 2015, simply because the raw compute power meant that the short keys were getting more practical to brute force. So this shows how designing the security of the system is a delicate task where you need to take these standards, interoperability and performance into consideration, but also recommendations from those who study algorithms and implementations to identify weaknesses and provide your guidance to mitigate those. So, for example, in choosing your RSA parameters, you need to select your private exponent. And for a long time, many used three until researchers found that this actually weakened the security of the system in some circumstances. So now we all use 65537 instead. And as we just discussed, we started to see concerns for the security of RSA and ECC crypto systems. So as soon as someone manages to build a quantum computer that is big enough, then all these systems are to be considered broken. We don't know if that's going to be in 10, 15, or 20 years, but there's so many resources being put into this that it will happen eventually. We sometimes refer to that concern as harvest now, decrypt later. So thinking, for example, of the pharma or automotive industry, it's not unlikely that data you protect today still has value in 15 years. But luckily, we also know that these quantum computers are not magical devices that solve every problem with the exponential speed up. So there are mathematical problems that work as trapdoor functions and can be computed efficiently on classical computers, but where the quantum computers do not have the same advantage. And these are used for post-quantum cryptography. So examples of such algorithms are lattice-based, hash-based, and code-based algorithms. And organizations can start protecting themselves from the quantum revolution by preparing for transitioning to standardized PQC algorithms now, wherever critical assets are protected with RSA or ECC schemes. So if you do not already have a cryptographic bill of materials, you really should start by making one, assess your assets against a threat, and start mapping out a plan for these systems that need to be changed. And any system that expects data to be kept secure for 10 years or more should be on the top of that list, in my opinion.
Thank you, Emil, for explaining this complex topic in such an elaborate way using simple to understand terms. Now, you do mention open standards being important in the whole process of identifying the cryptographic algorithms that will protect us for the next decades. This brings us to the next question. What is the industry doing in general to support PQC and NIST efforts?
Yeah, great, Roberto. Thanks for raising that fourth topic that we want to touch upon. And Emil, I think a lot of what you just laid out sounds like it is a task for risk management within the organizations, really, to analyze what they have today and then define a way going forward. And, you know, speaking of PQC and the NIST standardization efforts, maybe you can elaborate a bit on the activities that are ongoing within the broader cryptography research community and how that challenge is being approached. You know, Everyone's asking the questions, how far away from standardized algorithms and commercially available systems are we, and how would you recommend organizations approach this shift towards PQC, maybe from a timeline perspective?
I mean, designing a new crypto system is hard. So even if you know from a theoretical perspective, for example, that lattice-based algorithms work well for a post-quantum scheme, the way that you implement it can have significant or leave significant vulnerabilities behind. Just recently, there were concerns about the lattice problems that luckily turned out not to be to be justified, but it just shows how fragile this can be. So it really can't be understated how important trust is for those implementations and how important standards are for interoperability. So NIST was clever enough to run a competition for selecting the best candidates for PQC algorithms. And in 2023, we've seen the results of that work bearing fruit, with the first algorithms being selected for standardization, and a small handful of algorithms also being selected for the fourth round of standardization. So the goal is really to have selected algorithms for both signature and key exchange, or KEM, in 2024. There are already many vendors out there that are starting to implement support for those selected algorithms, and I expect that we'll see an increasing number of systems that support those through the course of 2024. NIST's Commercial National Security Algorithm Suite, or CNSA 2.0, already mandates that PQC is used for software and firmware signing for any national security systems in 2025, and by 2030, they demand that it's exclusively PQC for those purposes and network equipment. So if we go back to the term with a cryptographic bill of materials and the mitigation plan I mentioned earlier, I think we really need to be realistic that this will be a process for everyone. There's a lot of systems that need to change. There's a lot of vendors that need to be engaged, and a lot of software developers that will be busy making ends meet. So this is why I think it's extremely important for everyone to take advantage of this opportunity to introduce cryptographic agility in that process. We've already seen how difficult it was to transition from DES to AES, and how expensive it's been going from 1024-bit RSA keys to 2048-bit or ECC keys. So changing all these systems yet again will not be cheap. I mean, imagine the impact if it turns out that one of these selected PQC algorithms of today suddenly fall victim to a side channel attack that was not anticipated during the standardization project. So as we've seen with protocol stacks such as TLS, it's important that these systems are crypto agile, meaning that you can control the cryptographic parameters through policy rather than code. Some of these systems that are in use have cryptographic parameters that are hard-coded, and that'll be difficult to change quickly. Systems that have been architected to abstract those details away, for example, into cryptographic provider libraries, they may have an easier time to complete that transition. For example, by using cryptographic services that help centralize these policy decisions, or by reaching out to the vendor of those provider libraries or services to ensure that they are crypto-agile. And if you're building new systems, you really should take this into account today.
Thank you very much, Emil. You have provided some quite fascinating insights into the world of both quantum computing and post-quantum cryptography, two very distinctively different aspects of a fascinating future that lies ahead of us. It does, to me at least, sound like indeed the time is now to start approaching that migration path. And with that said, I would like to direct the next question towards our second guest, Sadiq Mohammed, Vice President Mobile Payment at MasterCard. Sadiq, maybe a few words about yourself and how you approach the topic of post-quantum computing and post-quantum cryptography within MasterCard.
Thanks, Joe. Hi, everyone. It's great to be here to discuss this exciting topic of quantum computing. I've been with MasterCard for about 15 years and currently lead product and commercialization for EMV-based products and services. This includes all EMV contactless cards, biometric cards, and also the chip applications that support digital wallets on mobile devices and wearables. In my role here at MasterCard, there is an element of how do we ensure the safety and security of our cards and devices in a post-quantum world, while also preserving the frictionless tap-and-go experience that our cardholders are used to. So from that position, I can say we have a strategy and plan to address this, and I'm happy to discuss some of the details.
Thank you, Sadiq. In your introduction, you hinted at the importance of having a plan for quantum computing. From your point of view, how will quantum computing impact the financial services industry?
Yeah, so as Emil explained earlier, quantum computing will exponentially increase computational power, opening new opportunities and threats in almost every field. And this includes the financial services industry. In the financial space, these enhanced computational capabilities will have significant impact on complex operations like financial simulation and modeling, portfolio optimization, and risk minimization. The opportunities are around getting faster results, sharper insights, and more accurate predictions that will enable better business decisions. From a risk perspective, once we get to systems approaching quantum level computation, it's possible that a bad actor could use quantum computing to attack current security and cryptography systems in the financial services industry. All sensitive financial information is stored and transmitted as encrypted data. And these data are protected using mathematical equations with a vast number of possible solutions. These encryption models are too complicated for classical computers to crack in a practical length of time. That all changes with quantum computing, which could potentially enable malicious actors to brute force through even the toughest protocols within hours. So putting together plans to address these threats is important.
Thank you, Sadiq, for sharing your thoughts on the impact of quantum computing on the financial services industries. It's again, the topic of opportunities on the one hand, but also the threats on the other hand. So that seems to be a recurring theme here. Maybe you can dive into some details as to how MasterCard is preparing for the age of quantum computing.
Sure. So at MasterCard, we're looking at quantum computing both from an opportunity and risk perspective. In fact, we have separate teams looking at this from different lenses. On the opportunities, our R&D teams are partnering with the likes of IBM, D-Wave, University College Dublin, and others to accelerate quantum computing research in financial services. As an example, today's financial services customers demand personalized products and services that rapidly anticipate their evolving needs and behaviors. So in this use case of customer targeting and prediction modeling, quantum computing could be a game changer. Using the power of quantum computing, we could efficiently maximize the value of a marketing campaign by sifting through large data sets and more accurately predicting which offers would be optimal for different cardholders. From a risk mitigation perspective, we've been taking inventory of critical payment infrastructure that heavily relies on cryptography. One such system our teams are looking at is the contactless payment system. MasterCard has been working with the industry to bring enhanced contactless specifications that will make contactless payments resistant to quantum attacks by enhancing the cryptographic methods used. This work will continue to evolve as we get newer cryptography methods like PQC.
It is very reassuring to see how you have started preparing for the journey towards quantum computing and how much of a C-level topic it is within your organization.
Thank you so much for sharing this information, Sadiq. I'm sure our listeners appreciate all the time and effort your organization is putting into this quite enormous technology shift. Speaking of shifts, I know, J. Arthur Tesis, you have been putting quite some effort into shifting and preparing your systems for the advent of quantum computing as well. If I understand correctly, you've put an early focus on looking at PKI and digital certificates in particular. Maybe you can share a bit about yourself and the work you have been doing and keep doing to prepare for quantum computing.
Yes, Joe, thanks for that. Also, thank you for the invitation. And I am truly honored to share with your audience and to have had the opportunity to collaborate with such a distinguished panel. I've been with Tesis, now a global payments company, for a little over 25 years. As a result of that, information security and cryptography have been a part of my world for a little while. However, more recently, it has been my joy to lead in just an awesome team of encryption and security professionals as director of the Encryption Services Consulting Organization. Our team is responsible for cryptographic research, analysis, architecture, assessment, and solution design across a massive payment processing IT infrastructure. And a major part of that cryptographic IT infrastructure and payment ecosystem involves asymmetric cryptography, and especially as it relates to public key infrastructure and digital certificates. And a major part of that has also been following the developments of quantum computing and post-quantum cryptography over the past 10 years. And I'm really excited about and actually had the honor of writing my first quantum computing application using Qiskit, running it on a 3-qubit quantum circuit out of IBM's Quantum Computing Research Center just last year. But as you've heard from the previous presenters, quantum computing will present a major problem for today's suite of traditional asymmetric cryptographic algorithms such as RSA and elliptic curve. And to put it more frankly, quantum computing all but annihilates the efficacy of these algorithms, which means that your HTTPS connections to your hosted cardholder payment web portals are at risk. Your point of sale terminals, which rely upon TLS, which is transport layer security, are also at risk. Your payment services, which rely upon integrator APIs that utilize TLS to protect the transaction payload, are at risk. The use of OpenPGP to protect files that contain cardholder data and privacy data are at risk. And certainly the list goes on. For any service or services that utilize the RSA and our elliptic curve algorithms. And perhaps one might say, okay, that's good to know, but how is this different from any other technology, any of the other stuff that we will eventually address sometime in the future when this quantum computing capability finally arrives? I like to try and contextualize this in a more practical example. I grew up in Gulfport, Mississippi, in the middle of what many would call hurricane country. And I have had the awesome and humbling experience of weathering multiple hurricanes. And the warnings go out for certain communities, certain areas to evacuate. But inevitably, there are some of those who will wait until the hurricane makes landfall, no matter how strong that hurricane has been classified. And so at landfall, it is too late to avoid the destructive power of a Category 5 hurricane. And I think quantum computing has very similar properties. Once quantum computing makes landfall, for those who have done nothing to prepare, the impacts will most likely be devastating, because the reality is that the foundations of our existing and traditional asymmetric cryptography simply will not hold up.
Thanks, J. Arthur, for providing that great insight. The hurricane metaphor really drives home the potential impact, and it feels that there is a call to action here. So it really begs the question, what do we do now?
We do have some help out there, and there's an organization called the CAB Forum, which is the composed of your trusted third-party certificate authority vendors and the leading internet browser vendors, which regulate policy for how internet-facing or public-facing HTTPS TLS certificates are managed. And the CAB Forum has been in the background helping the entire industry move towards a better certificate ecosystem that has built-in crypto agility. And again, crypto agility is that ability to quickly transition from one cryptographic system to another. And what the CAP Forum has been strategically doing is to reduce the expiry period for TLS certificates. And what we have seen is that we have moved from 2-year expiry to now 13 months, which allows the worldwide certificate ecosystem to be in position to quickly replace these certificates that are vulnerable to quantum computing attacks. And it's very likely that that expiry period will be reduced further. And from that perspective, every quantum computing strategic preparation plan should have a line item for addressing crypto agility around TLS certificates. And the thing is that for anyone that is listening who has ever had the experience of manually replacing TLS certificates, be it for web servers, enterprise applications, security devices, or other technologies, it can be a very tedious, cumbersome, and time-consuming process. And when we consider that the reduction in TLS certificates is likely to be reduced to 90 days or less, operational teams simply will not be able to manually keep up with replacing those certificates, which is why your strategy needs a certificate lifecycle management system that we will call a CLMS. And what a mature certificate lifecycle management system will do, it will allow for the discovery of certificates throughout one's public and private IT infrastructure, because the adage is that one cannot manage what one cannot measure. And that certainly applies here. And so we need a good inventory of all of our TLS certificates within our enterprise. And that's something that is essential. And one of the other significant items for your certificate lifecycle management system is that it can assist in the automation of certificate renewals and replacement. And this is especially important as we know that a additional reduction to the expiry period is on the horizon. Now, I want to be clear here that even with a certificate lifecycle management system, the current asymmetric cryptography is still in trouble. As has been shared by my colleagues here, TLS certificates based on the RSA and E elliptic curve algorithms, they're still vulnerable. But fortunately, there is still some positive news, and there's some practical work that's taken place that leverages post-quantum safe algorithms in TLS certificates. They are something called hybrid HTTPS and TLS certificates that are being functionally and operationally tested that have the benefit of being consumable by current IT systems that only understand the traditional RSA and elliptic curve parameters, and being consumable by updated IT systems that understand post-quantum safe algorithms and parameters, such as crystals, dilithium, or falcon. And perhaps the most valuable benefit in hybrid certificates is the means to offer a transition path from our traditional certificate infrastructure to quantum safe certificates without being too disruptive.
Great. Thank you very much, Jay Arthur. So listening to what you just lay out, I think a lot of it ties back to something that Emil mentioned earlier. I think he called it a cryptography bill of material, or CBOM. So that seems to be quite important to know what you don't know is there, you can't manage. So it's also great to hear that the industry is coming together through the CAB forum to address those fundamental challenges. And so, you know, Jay Arthur, to me, now the question really is, so where do we test this stuff?
And even further than that, have you considered setting up a PQC lab for testing hybrid TLS certificates and other PQC technologies? Have you talked with your existing trusted third-party CA vendor? The latter may already have resources that are helpful.
Those are great questions, and it is so important to keep our vendors in mind, because we are going to need to upgrade our existing PKI systems to support these post-quantum safe algorithms. Some may consider leveraging reputable vendor offerings for PQC entropy as a service to improve our existing PKI key generation, where we gain high fidelity entropy to improve the randomness and security bit strength of our existing keys, as well as keys that will be used in our post-quantum safe algorithms. But lastly, I strongly recommend to our listeners to start talking to your vendors about certificate crypto agility. Ask how they are going to make it easier for you to integrate with your CLMS. Ask what they are going to do to begin supporting post-quantum safe algorithms. Ask your vendors about making available to you some of their resources, their post-quantum labs, in regards to that question about where do we test this stuff. Lean on your vendors to provide that type of support. Ask them if they have a roadmap for utilizing hybrid TLS certificates. Because the bottom line here, we are all going to need help in this journey. And our vendors are going to play a major role in filling the gaps.
Thanks indeed, Jay Arthur. It takes a village, as they say, right, to get that nut cracked. So thanks very much for sharing this quite actionable guidance. And I, you know, listening to you laying out what TSYS and Global Payments are doing, I would hope that other organizations are equally ahead of the curve in their preparations. And speaking of preparations, I would like to quickly circle back to the initial question. What is quantum computing and why should you care about it now? We do believe between Emil, Sadiq, and Jay Arthur, we've given you, our listeners, some strong pointers of why we are convinced that, in fact, you should care about quantum computing and its effects, both the opportunities as well as the threats on your businesses, and start preparing for this massive shift now.
Thank you, Joe. I'd like to thank our panelists and my co-host. This concludes our podcast, Preparing for the Rise of Quantum Computing Opportunities and Threats to Your Business. We hope to have provided some food for thought and hope that you will join us for future episodes exploring the effects of PQC on global supply chains for the financial system.
Thank you for listening to this U.S. Payments Forum podcast on quantum computing. I hope that you found it just as insightful as I did. If you are interested in listening to more U.S. Payments Forum podcasts, I invite you to visit our website at www.uspaymentsforum.org. There, you'll also be able to learn more about our in-person events, access white papers written by our members, and materials on any and everything U.S. payments related. Thanks for listening.